The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm with Isabel Clendenin, one of the owners of Au Bon Clément and now one of the winemakers. Isabel, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Just to let everyone know, I was at a wine dinner at the National Club a couple days. Well, by the time this is on, you know what? Dates don't really matter. Time doesn't matter. But a wine event at the National Club with your wines. It was a spectacular night. So let's first talk about just the portfolio. What do you guys do and what do you guys represent?
Au Bon Clément, which is our main big brand, is all Burgundian varietals, so Pinot Noir and Chardonnay predominantly, but we have two white blends containing Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, and or Aligoté.
When you guys say that you're doing it the Burgundian style, what does that mean? Because I always hear that, and some places feel like they do, others feel like they just like to use the word Burgundian, but what does that mean for you and for your family?
So, yeah, oftentimes, when I first say it, Burgundian style, I mean Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but I believe that we go a bit farther than that, than just the varietals. My father, who started Au Bon Clément in 1982, Jim Clendenin, focused very much on what he wanted out of wine when he fell in love, and he fell in love in Burgundy. Mm-hmm. Henri Jaillet was who he was mentored by, who is an incredibly big name in Burgundy. And he wanted to bring to the New World in California, where we're located, wines that were not above 14%, had excellent acidity, and were ageable and meant to be done with food. And so I guess that's adding to the Burgundian style meaning.
Yeah, and that could be hard to do where you guys are, just to keep it under, you know, like, and try to get in that sweet spot of like 13.5%. And then it's certainly during the waves of just the styles of California wine, that could have been tricky as well, because there was the period of everything was supposed to be big and full powered and full throttled. And, you know, I've seen shifts in some Pinot producers where certain vintages, I'm like, did you put some Syrah in this? Like, just really big. That must have been tough sometimes to push back against some of those trends.
Yeah. First, we are very lucky because we are in Santa Barbara, and our facility and a lot of the vineyards we source from are in the Santa Maria Valley. Mm-hmm. So there's these lovely mountains that trap the coastal frog in to keep it nice and cool, and it burns off by midday to give the fruit enough time to ripen. And so it's pretty possible for us to get 13.5 as long as you're checking
right.
The sugars.
Yeah.
But even more so with... It's really funny because so many people say, like, oh, your wine is so trendy now. And I've never considered Au Bon Clément trendy a day in my life. Dad was very, very specific on this is the style he wanted. If other people didn't like it in the area, he wasn't going to change. He was going to make them change.
Right.
And so it's so ironic that we've come all the way around to being trendy. And in 5 years, if there's a possibility we're not trendy again, we're still going to be making what
we're
making.
You're going to be okay with that. Actually, you know what? It's funny. You're the first winemaker, wine owner that I've talked to from the Santa Barbara area. And you sort of talked about just about the impact of what the wind and the fog and that can help keep things cool. Is there other stuff people need to know about that area versus, because when you think California wine, a lot of people are like, oh, Sonoma, Napa, and then it kind of ends there.
So Santa Barbara is, depending on how you drive, 4 to 6 hours south of that area.
Now, when you're driving, is it 4 hours or is it more 6 hours?
I very rarely drive to Sonoma.
Okay.
I drive as legally as I need to.
Okay. I like that. That leaves a lot of wiggle room. By the way, okay, totally off topic. Then we'll get back to Santa Barbara. Wine owners are some of the best drivers, because so many of them, when they take people on tours, either friends or media or buyers, they'll, okay, hop in the Jeep and we're going to, I'll take you a tour of the vineyards. And those are small roads and those are bumpy. And sometimes you're driving up mountains like I've done in Germany or in South Africa. I think wine owners, I think they're some of the best drivers out there.
I agree, even though that absolutely terrifies me. I'm definitely more of the ATV up the side
right.
of the mountain
yeah.
for my sanity.
Yeah.
But I did learn to drive by when I had my permit. I had my one of my parents with me, and then I'd oftentimes have to shuttle a bunch of drunk drivers.
Yes.
Or a bunch of potential drunk drivers that thankfully weren't.
Yes.
And so when you're driving and you are younger and you're dealing with a bunch of drunk people in the back, they're going to tell you how you're driving.
Oh.
And so there have been a couple of times where I go, I'm the one who can see straight.
Yeah.
That's the reason we're being driven this way. But it forces you to get pretty good.
And also, you know, I think you are allowed at that point to give a very well-meaning fuck off, you know, to the people in the back if they're doing that. Okay, so sorry, back to Santa Barbara, just some of the major differences between there and, say, Napa or Sonoma.
Okay, so I would say weather. We are very much a cooler region. We are very beach near, so we do have areas in, like, the San Ynez Valley, which is farther south of Santa Maria, but in the same county. Really awesome sandy soil, and there feels like there's so many differences, but also just the philosophy is different, because mm-hmm. I'd say the Sonoma coast is closer to Santa Barbara County wines than any other area up
okay.
north. So if you're familiar with that area, if you understand those wines, we make wines that are comparable. We focus very intensely on brickage. We would like to pick between 23, 24 bricks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and coastal fog, I know that they have it, but I don't think their layout supports the trapping the fog
right.
as well as Santa Barbara does.
Yeah.
I know there's probably some big, intricate details that differentiate them that I'm not thinking of, but yeah. those are kind of it.
Yeah. Well, let's get to you. I mean, obviously, we'll talk about your father, obviously, just, you know, famous guy and just a force in the wine industry. But how did, like, was it always inevitable that you were going to get into wine? Did you push back at some point? Like, what was your journey into all this?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. My brother has always been expected to overtake the wine business.
Right.
Dad was like, okay, you're going to learn these things. You're going to be a winemaker. You're going to go and do a harvest in France with one of my friends. Like, this is what's going to happen. And for me, he was like, what do you want to be? And as a very, very small child, my two answers were fashion designer
yep.
and biomedical engineer that's going to cure cancer and Alzheimer's disease.
Wow, that is a lot of range.
Yes.
That is a lot of range for you.
And I went to college and I studied cellular biology pre-med with the hope of doing, I wanted to do MD, PhD, which meant I was going to be in university forever.
Yes.
But the college I went to, Bennington College, has a mandatory internship period every winter because they don't want to pay for heating.
Yeah.
it's in Vermont. And one of those periods, I went to the University of San Francisco to work in labs there. And I fell in love with getting to work there. It was very enjoyable, but I'm someone who gets a bit on the sensitive side. I get stressed out easily to the point I have a lovely diagnosis of a fun disease called panic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I was going through this training and I was understanding the gravity of what I was going to be doing, and if I wasn't going to be doing it right, or if I made a mistake, people's lives were literally on the line. And so I started developing stress ulcers.
Right.
And stomach bleeding, which was super fun. And then the icing on the cake for that was the lovely man who I was working under at USF passed away in his early 50s of a stress-related heart disease on my birthday.
Oh, my God.
So the universe, obviously his passing was not the universe assigned to me.
But yeah, yeah,
if the universe was saying anything to at the time, it was maybe this is not right for you. And at that same time, along with cellular biology, I was learning Japanese. That was my other major in college because I love Japan. And so I was going to Japan and working with our wine distributors as a language exchange. And I fell in love with being able to present our wine and our story and educate people on how Chardonnay is supposed to taste in our mind. I wasn't getting stress ulcers while doing that. And so I wanted to explore that more. After college, I went home and I started working for the business. And it was actually kind of ironic because I'd say a year or two into working full time. So that was like late 2017, early 2018. My dad turns to me and goes, "So what are you going to do with your life? Like, what's your next training? What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Well, that's an awkward question."
Yeah, I'm doing it.
And he went, "What do you mean?" And I'm like, "Well, if I'm not currently in training to work deeper in the wine business now, then I don't understand why I'm doing this work." And I just don't think he was shocked. And a few days later, he came back to me. He was really good at ruminating on things and started more intensely actually trying to show me things, especially building palate, which matters a lot to us. And so it was very wild because I just think for so many years I said, "Oh, I was never going to work in the wine business," that he never thought to ask me to work there.
Right. So do you think his almost confusion or him not thinking about you in the wine business, that was because you didn't show interest in the past? Or is there any of it that was maybe more the European influence? Because what I found is in North America and Europe, because in Spain, like Rueda, lots of female winemakers. But I remember being in Germany, it was passed down to the son, like that very much more just traditional old way of doing things. Do you think any of that was part of your dad? And not that he didn't want you being in the business, but maybe it sort of blinded him to this reality that was always in front of him?
Yeah, I think he saw growing up, I was always very, very scientifically minded, but with this weird creativity I really love baking, not because I have to follow a recipe, but because I understand the chemical rules and I like to see what I can make within those rules,
right?
Which is a weird mix. And so I think he saw that and saw what I always said I wanted to do, what I was always interested in, and just figured I'm not going to be able to change her mind because I was as stubborn as he was. And then on top of that, I do think it was a bit of, well, I have two kids. This one's the older one, and she clearly wants to do scientific fashion. My young one has a great cult of personality, and he's a boy. I can get him to do the hard work.
Right.
He doesn't have a Southern accent. I don't know where that came.
I was going to say.
When I talk like this, this is definitely my dad impression.
Right. But then if you keep doing it now, you get a little bit of a Southern accent starts coming in when you start doing it.
Yeah, that's totally my mom's side. So I don't know where it came from for this.
Well, actually, it's interesting. You say, you were into science and creative. Well, that kind of is a lot of what it means to be a winemaker is using science. And it's always that dance for most winemakers is you've got to follow certain rules. But if you follow all the rules and the wine tastes the same every year, you might as well work for J-Lore. It is sort of and again, nothing wrong with J-Lore. It has its place within the wine world. But when I think of a good winemaker, it's part science, part rules, but then also just the creativity to say, fuck it, let's try this.
Yeah, I'd never thought about it that way originally, and I must confess I am neither athletic nor a morning person, mm-hmm. So the idea of doing harvest, that I'm currently doing. I'm having a lovely break in Canada for 4 days before going back. I never thought that I could do the wine industry, especially because everyone goes, so did you work at a winery before Bon Climat? Mm-hmm. And yes, technically I did. My mother had a lovely small winery focusing on Viognier in Buellton, California. And my brother and I were definitely a big part of her winemaking team. My brother did a lot of the cellar rattery, was very fast at being able to whip around in a forklift. And I did all of our lab work and sulfurs. But early on, we also did like vineyard help. And
Okay, hold on, I guess. How much winter pruning have you done?
No winter pruning. More suckering than I'll ever do in my life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because we're laughing about before at the event is that working a harvest means you're up early and you're working. I mean, that is not an easy job.
No, it is not. And I'm always been more of a like head type person. What's the word? It starts with like an I.
Intuitive?
No, but like the... Well, cerebral, okay, not the right word, yeah. But I've always been more of a cerebral person and not very much a physical person. And so when you're doing all this physical work, it's virtually impossible to be a cerebral person at the same time. So yeah. I felt like I was losing brain cells as I was doing it. Of course, like once you have the opportunity to sleep more than 4 hours, the brain cells come back, but it's just like... I do work now.
Well, because it's also, yeah, when you're doing the physical labor and you're out there in the fields, it's like you almost have to just completely shut everything off. It's just do this one task, get this task done, get this. And then you got to kind of just put everything else away because you're focusing. And, you know, if you screw that up, there's consequences. Okay, we'll get back. I want to get back more into you as a winemaker and also your dad, but just a little bit. You're here in Toronto. How has your travels been? Because like, if you've some that represents your wine, that means you spend a lot of times in cabs, Ubers, planes, and hotels. So how's this trip been for you?
The trip has been fantastic. I was kind of scared really bad about the Toronto airport. I was told that things were going to be a pain and that my luggage was not going to arrive.
Yes.
And it was a very smooth trip. There was only one minor weird situation with another passenger, which normally on plane flights, there's at least three or four. And then I got in, I found my bag, it was here, so I didn't have to lug around the extra outfit the entire time. The lovely people at Wine All Online picked me up from the airport, so everything has been fantastically smooth.
Good, yeah. Shout out to Wine Online. Sam, people who listen to this podcast, Sam Fritz Tate has been on this podcast many, many episodes ago. You can find him. Their portfolio is fantastic, and they certainly champion you guys. Maybe you don't know this. What is the relationship with Clément, with your winery, and Toronto and Canada? Is there a lot of it in our country? Is it still fairly new?
In Canada, we've been around for quite a while. Previously, the only place in Canada I've ever been was Vancouver. Mm-hmm. BC, we've been selling for forever. We also seem to sell wine in Alberta, but I'm not aware of the...
Probably Calgary. I imagine especially like Calgary when the oil's good. And then that area, they'll spend money. They'll spend money out on their dinners and things like that.
And
by the way, not that your wines are like crazy, crazy expensive, but they're not. You know, they're not not the $17 Tuesday night wine as well.
Yeah, in Canadian dollars, definitely not.
Yeah.
So, yes, and then for Toronto and Ontario, we have been in the market before. We were with a different distributor, and. My dad is an incredibly loyal person,
gotcha.
But he also is someone that, especially at a certain point in his life, needed to know that even on a superficial level, that you understood that his time was important. Like, he spent 200 days on the road out of 365. So he very much valued his time traveling, and apparently the guy who is in charge of the distributorship was not very good at that type of hospitality.
Right.
And so there was an infraction that occurred where Dad left with not the most positive outcome.
Gotcha.
So I'm very happy for us to be back in the market. With Wine Online, Sam had been trying really hard to get Dad into the market. But he had this lovely friend named Megan who had joined his team. And Dad had heard of Megan from a wine personality. And so he was very intrigued by her. And so on her, apparently her first day at Wine Online, I did not know that half of it, she calls up the winery. And my dad, especially later on, but he, one of his number one jobs at the winery was cooking lunch for everyone on staff.
Really?
Yeah, because lunch has always been a very, very important come together at a Bon Clima. There's 4 to 13 wines on the table, and you're trying them all with this fantastically fresh made food. And it's this one really long dining table. So you all have to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And you talk about the food, you talk about the wine, you make the mistake of bringing up some new politic that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good time, and it's every day at lunch. Like, if Dad was on the road, maybe they'd get pizza or deli day. But typically, actually, our current cellar master, Kike, would do all the cooking when Dad was gone and is currently doing most of the cooking now. But she called during lunch. You don't call during lunch. Okay. 9 times out of 10, if you call during lunch, you wouldn't get anything.
Right.
No one would pick up. Or if someone picked up and they were asking for Dad, they wouldn't get him. And then, 5% of the time, he'd pick up because he'd feel indignant that someone was calling during lunch and go, "Do you know what time it is? How could you expect me to answer questions during lunch? Do you know what I do?"
Poor Megan.
But with Megan, she called during lunch, and I think it was Randy. Randy said, "This woman, Megan from Ontario, is on the phone for you. And he goes, "Give me the phone." And so he talks to her at length. They're having a good time.
Oh.
I wouldn't even say that's 5% of the time. This is the only time I've ever heard of this happening. And after that call, Dad looked at everyone, went, "I guess we're selling to Ontario."
I wish there was a transcript of that conversation.
Right? I was not there at the day when that happened, but when I came into the winery next, several people brought up that happened.
Right.
It was so shocking that people were like, "What? Do you know who this is?" I obviously had no clue, but I'm really glad it worked out.
Yeah. Well, let's just talk about your dad for a little bit, because again, kind of a force of nature, and and tragically passed not that long ago. But for people listening, what should they know about your dad and how important he is to everything around here?
Well, I guess just for posterity and have Dad's response for what people should know, people should already know about him. but if you don't...
For the 1% listening that don't.
Yeah, I won't take it personally, but I know Dad would have. So my dad, Jim Clendenin, was a Ohio boy from a family of coal miners, and his dad got out of coal mining to be a part of tire manufacturing. A big step up, but still very much manufacturing, salt of the earth, American workers. And so Donald, my grandfather that I've never met, he moved the family from Ohio to Orange County in California because he'd gotten a job promotion. And so Dad went from being an Ohio boy to being a California guy.
That's a hell of a switch.
Yeah. Ended up going to UCSB. He was pre-law, and something switched, and he didn't want to be pre-law anymore. So he had gone on this Europe trip and fell in love with France and Burgundy. And so he went back to work harvest. He also worked harvest in Australia. And then he came back and was working for a winery that still exists in the area called Zacca Mesa.
Mm-hmm.
He was assistant winemaker under Ken Brown, and this was in the 70s. And Old Bon Climat started in the 80s, 1982. And eventually he went from the dairy barn they allowed him to make his wine in on the Zacca Mesa Los Alamos property to our still very warehouse-looking facility in Santa Maria on Vallecito. But he really loved how Europe made wine and how the whole culture of a group food time and community. And he wanted wines that you can drink that way, because drinking in Europe is an all-day affair.
Yeah.
And when you're drinking some of our other California friends, if that's an all-day affair, you're going to be blacked out by 2?
Yes. I'd say by 2 o'clock. And that's with the help of water and bread, trying to keep you till 2 o'clock.
Exactly. And he thought that was preposterous and didn't understand the point. And so he wanted to try to push this European agenda for a more peaceful communal time into California winemaking.
It also speaks to the power of Burgundy. I mean, here's your father who, you know, grew up among like coal miners, and they go into tires, and now he goes to Burgundy. And so he's like, oh, wait a minute. Everything that I've known is now going to be something completely different. It does speak to the power of Burgundy. So you were saying off the beginning, not only, you know, obviously one of the owners, but now making the wine. Do you ever feel stress? Like you were talking before about just your own anxieties and stress ulcers and things like that, but something much more important on the medical side, which is way, 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 way more important than figuring out, okay, is this going to be 13.1 or 13.3% Pinot? But now that your influence is going to be in each bottle, do you feel any stress? Do you feel any stress there?
Yes. Yeah. Short answer is yes. But I have a fantastic production team. Most of them have been with us over 10 years. Quite a few have been with us over 20 years. And I have 2 people on the team who are now both part owners that have been with the company for over 30 years.
Right.
So we have the consistency. And it used to be a negative thing, but I have a terrible house palate. If it's a Pinot Noir and Chardonnay that we don't make, I like it if it tastes similar to us.
Right.
And I can pick out similarities, and I like certain vineyards that we've always been very tied to, like Sanford and Benedict. And so I don't feel like I've ever had to worry about my palate being a big changer. But more importantly than that, I am not the winemaker. We have Jim Edelman, who's a fantastic winemaker, who's now just head of our production as well. And Kike, who is our cellar master, so he has grandmaster over the whites. And then Mark Pirot is our official assistant winemaker, and he's fantastic. He has a small brand as well that he makes that are very fantastic wines as well. And then we have our ragtag team of other production crew that I've now, for 3 years, I've at least helped out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The first year I was shadowing interns because I wanted to be able to hear stupid questions asked and whisper my stupid question for them to ask because I didn't want anyone to be upset with me. To last year where I tried my hardest to just be into harvest full force, but with loss and the fact that I'm not an athletic person, there were just days where my anxiety and stress would take over, and unless people wanted to deal with someone violently crying while on top of the crusher destemmer,
I
spent a lot more days at home than I would have wanted. Mm-hmm. But this year, I've been in it. Obviously, I'm here right now, so I'm getting a tiny break, but
But it still work. I mean, it's not the same. It's not the same physical thing, but you still are here. You did a great job at the National Club.
Thank you still so much.
Yeah. Oh, no. It was such a great event. I mean, we'll talk about the wines in a moment, but it still is work here. You're getting out here, getting your wines and going to some of the more important wine hubs in Toronto. You mentioned Granite Club or Peter Pan, which is a great place. There's a lot of cool spots that you can go to. So, I mean, you are still working. It's just different work.
Yes, I know. I don't have to put on liquid resistant gloves and get splattered by juice for all the hours of the day.
No, but you are going to have to deal with Toronto traffic. By the way, Nuit Blanche is going on. Be careful trying to drive in this city. Try walking as much as you can.
Oh, yeah. So I actually heard about Nuit Blanche for the first time last night.
Yeah.
One of our Chardonnays, our highest-end Chardonnay, is called Nuit Blanche Bouge.
That's right.
So when someone said, oh, the Nuit Blanche, I thought that they were, like, pranking me. I was like, is there a wine expedition I didn't know about? I also learned that there's apparently a wine here called Nuit Blanche, and I'm watching them.
Theirs is probably not as good. By the way, shout out
to Canadian wines. So yeah. You're the one offending them.
Hey, listen, I love Canadian wine, and I love it not because of some sort of patriotism. We make killer good stuff. We make great Chardonnays, great Rieslings.
I had Lighthall Riesling last night.
Yep.
That was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terrible because, like, normally if I see a really cool label that I like, I go, cool, I'm not trying that because it'll make me sad. But I love Luna Moths, and it had it on the Lighthall Riesling. I was like, oh, I really want to try that. And it was very good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's down in Prince Edward County. And there's some really good Chardonnay producers literally down the road from where that one is. So, but yeah, your Nuit Blanche, the 14. What an incredible wine. And people listening, if they could go and find it, I definitely recommend it. It still has a lot of years of life in it. But that 8-year-old Chard, just the complexity, the richness on the mid, that was a great wine. I think that and I think your 08, I got to take a look at the list again. I'll know when I see it. But I think your 2014, the Blanche Chardonnay was my favorite.
Oh, yeah, that, and it worked so well with the scallops that the National Club paired it with.
Yes.
It was excellent.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. The other one, the Mendelssohn Russian River 2014 Pinot. That was that was a killer wine as well. Okay, that's Bad Pod. We're just now looking at the winemaker dinner pamphlet here and going over it. Bad Pod, bad by me. How about yourself, though? Like, so you're getting more and more into just the nuts and bolts of all the winemaking. Is that sort of where you want to see yourself for the next couple of years?
So my favorite part of the winemaking process is blending.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah, I love flavor. I mean, my sense of smell and sense of taste were tested from a very, very young age. There's this little French game where they have these little, like, essential oil crystals in these pots, and the label for the pot is on the bottom, but it's like this smell bingo where you have this bingo card, and the first person to fill it out with the correct scent wins.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother and I have played that game since I was probably, like, 8, and he would have been 4.
What a winemaker family game to play.
Yes, we definitely still have it at home, but the scents have weakened severely over the years.
How competitive are you and your brother? I mean, simply, like, how competitive are the two of you with the whole wine industry, either blind tasting or working? Is this a succession thing? I'm trying to remember the characters' names. I just watched the show. Like,
I haven't seen the show, but I've heard it's amazing.
It is amazing. It's I mean, obviously, no other family should be like the succession family. They're all miserable. But how competitive are you and your brother?
Okay, so thankfully no one can see how violently my eyes lit up at that question. And obviously you can hear my smile. So in my opinion, I'm not very competitive. However,
what would he say?
My brother thinks I am the most competitive person on the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he mistakes, because I can be competitive. I used to have a lot more problems with that, but I'm not a very athletic person, and I'm so-so at board games. So there's only
right.
so much com- competition you can be. And I like playing games that I'm still bad at, which is typically a pretty good indicator that I'm not that sore of a loser.
Yeah, you're not the crazy.
Yeah. I'm not the let me toss the game of Risk because I've lost Australia. But
how do you lose Australia? It's down in the corner. And that's why you go
that's
for
that's why
the,
you toss the board.
Yeah, that's why you toss. By the way, the people that try to win with Europe, that is so hard.
The people who play Risk concern me.
Yeah.
The only version of Risk I'm good at all is Star Wars Risk. Shout out to Planets. Ooh. But so he thinks that I'm outrageously competitive. But when I was younger, I was. For example, my brother learned how to ride a bike a few hours before I did.
Yes.
I thought it was impossible until I saw that idiot doing it. And he is not stupid. But at the time, I definitely thought that.
That was your perception.
Yes. And so I was like, if he can do it, I have to be able to do it. There's no way. And so he always thought that as competition. But nowadays, for certain things that he sees as competitive, it's more inner anxiety. Mm-hmm. I have these personal expectations of myself and then that are annoyingly high. And then I have these perceived expectations from other people that I haven't validated. They probably don't have them. But I'm like, okay, if he's more athletic than I am, so he's doing all these punch downs. So now I need to do punch downs too to prove that I'm not just lazy. But I have terrible balance. So
Don't do punch downs.
Yeah.
Don't do punch downs then.
So I learned that there is a compromise on our smaller fermenters. I can take a bench to the side and then I can do the punch down, which is harder than putting it on the side because of the body weight.
Yeah.
So I've definitely like almost pulled a shoulder, but I don't have to worry about falling into the wine. And that's very important. My number one harvest job, I wanted to say it earlier, but I didn't put it in properly, is working the top of the crusher destemmer. Certain places, their top of a crusher destemmer is just this like weird funnel, so you're not really doing anything. You're scraping grapes into it, and it just goes off. Ours is a little bit different. It's this big metal hopper that has this rotating coil that the grapes then go through this much, much smaller hole. So you have to evenly rake all of the grapes from the side that's close to the hole to the opposite side so that they don't all get jammed. But more importantly than that, you're also doing quality control of the fruit that you're bringing in. Also making sure there's no lizards. I've had to rescue a handful of live lizards.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder what that would. Yeah, that would certainly add an odd funk, I think, to the aromatics. But so you save lizards. I mean, yeah, that's dangerous. That's dangerous what you're doing there.
No. Thankfully, not that dangerous. Okay. It's a rotating thing, and you're leaning over, and as long as you don't put yourself in it, you're fine.
Okay. Yeah.
But my favorite comment that some of my more edgy, older winemaker friends go is, "Oh, that's the easiest harvest job. One of the easiest harvest jobs," and I originally was being like got really offended, but then I realized it's only the easiest job if you're not doing the job.
Right.
Because if you're not paying attention to like, oh, the fruit looks fantastic, but there's this one section that looks like it might have this bunch looks like it might have sour rot. You take that bunch out so that you don't have the heightened volatile acidity from it. Or these look amazing, but this one seems like it was a bit older, so it's got a little bit of green mold on it. You take that out so you're not making a wine with kind of a mildewy taste.
Yeah.
So like they're very important to take those things out. And like when I'm on top of the crusher destemmer, I go through 2 to 4 waste buckets.
Right.
So they have to take, because I'm taking out leaves and sticks and these bunches that are intolerable for us.
You're you're one of the tip of the spears to the quality. Like
yes.
For quality control.
At least for the past couple of years. So if there is any problems, I guess you can directly blame me for that one. For fruit quality only. But when other people had done the job, when I'm not there for like, or if I'm doing office work, they'll have like one bucket or a half bucket that they've gone through. And so originally I thought it was just, they were like, oh, this is something that you didn't fall into the machine. You can do it. But at the end of this harvest, I've kind of felt like I'm one of the people that's really good at doing that here.
Yeah, well, it's meticulous. And also, it's, you know, it's kind of your name.
Yeah.
You know.
And I'm pretty neurotic. But actually, so we're a collective called CLV. Our facility is a collective. So we actually have more than just Au Bon Climat produced there. And so it's not just my fruit that I'm doing this quality control for, but other producers, because we all do work together.
Right. Okay.
So it is my name, but I don't want to act like as soon as like Hitching Post Pinot Noir is, I'm just turning a blind eye. Right, I'm doing the same level of neuroticism.
Yes. And picking the wine from sideways there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, in the Hitching Post. Do you feel, is there pressure just because this is the family business, that wine represents your family and your past and your father and you and your brother and your mom, and like when you're doing the blending, because that's a very important job, like, you know, I don't even want to do it in the sense of pressure, just that this is it an honor. What does it feel like knowing that this is you've had the baton now from your family to keep this going?
Yeah, it's giant shoes to fill. I'm lucky that I only have to fill one shoe and my brother can fill the other. Mm-hmm. He's currently doing harvest right now. Probably today, Saturday, he's doing harvest as we speak for sure.
Yeah.
I did maybe steer away from how much stress sometimes parts of this job is, but I really value the personal significance. Because it gives me motivation to do my job and to work my hardest. But at the same time, it's not literally life or death.
Yeah.
And so having my background helps put some of these things into perspective. But my biggest fear is making sure that people see that we're continuing trying to make things how they're supposed to be.
Right.
My biggest joy is being able to see how much people have grown to love and appreciate our style of wine. So there is pressure, but it is such an honor. I'm so lucky. I'm literally, in our family, I was always told, you're never going to be a salesperson. You are way too candid. If you don't like something, you're going to tell people. And you can't do that if you're selling things. And I'm really lucky because I can get behind everything that we're doing, which makes it much easier.
No, it is. Yeah, it is an honor and it is cool. But then also you get to put your spin on it. And I think the fact that you had those 2.5 buckets filled of just twigs and bad grapes, that also screams to your pride and your work ethic. You know, the fact that he's like, no, I'm going to go through this meticulously because this is, you know, part of my legacy. One thing I appreciate about you guys is and it's funny, no one ever wants to use the word inexpensive or this or that, but your entry-level wine. Like, the first wine we tried was your more entry-level Chardonnay. And I always appreciate, I remember with Gugel, his Cote de Rhone spent like 18 months in oak. I'm like, oh, good for you. And you put the time and effort. Your entry-level Chardonnay was damn good. And plenty of complexity and just, you know, what you want from California Chard. And that's one thing I appreciate is like when the entry level is good, then you can get excited about everything that's going to be next because the pride is there. What are incorrect perceptions or what are correct perceptions of California wine? Because one thing I notice, and we were laughing about this, if you're into wine, there's a couple things you need to do. One, you need to profess your love for German Riesling. If you don't, your wine card will be taken away. This cabal of wine people will say, what do you mean you don't love Mosel Riesling? Give us that card. Get out of here. And the other thing is you need to spend a couple hours a week shit-talking California wine. It's just part of the thing. It's a stereotype, and yet so many of us are guilty at times. I can list all my favorite California winemakers, but what are some of the perceptions out there that you want to just push back and tell people to fuck off?
Yeah, well, one, obviously I was probably biased, but as a child, California wine country was Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
So when I learned about this weird place called Napa, and there was wine there too, and not only that, it was the wine that people thought was California wine. I was, at the ripe old age of 10, already kind of bitter. So I will express that bias. I'm like, how are these people being recognized for wine when we've been doing it all this time? Because they had two just in a different area. But California wine, because of Napa, has this gigantic skew of perception of wines over 14 with oak that is smellable from the room away,
right.
Off dry, and honestly not very acidic,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
is very much the opposite of what we do. And so those perceptions, I'm time and time again, because I spent a lot of my time in our tasting room, so talking DTC, direct to consumer, with people and hearing some of the interesting questions I could get.
Can we, this is going to sound weird because we're in your hotel room. Can we role play for a moment here?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to be the consumer and I'm going to say the line you've heard more than any other. Do you have anything that isn't Chardonnay? I don't like Chardonnay. I don't like the big, flabby, oaky thing. Do you have anything else?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I understand your perception of California Chardonnay. But I would highly encourage you to try ours because the alcohol content is 13.5. It is a dry take on Chardonnay, and it has enough acidity that instead of that movie theater butter you might be afraid of, mm-hmm. I think you're going to find a nice creaminess and fruit in it. So just give it a try yeah. for me.
The amount of times you've had to do that, I can't even imagine. And you know, anyone who listens to pod on a regular basis knows I always have my battle between what's the better white. Is it Chardonnay or Riesling? And it's always a battle, and it's those two first, and then to me it goes down a tier. And great Chardonnay is one of the best things out there. You can have it with steak. And whenever someone says, I don't like Chardonnay, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I got this bottle of Montrachet. I got this bottle of this. I guess you don't want any. So more for me. You know, and that perception... Well, it's like a lot. I mean, it's kind of a wine thing. All the bad perceptions. All Riesling is goopy sweet. All Chardonnay is too oaky. All California is 15.5%. And it's, you know, it's one thing that part of this podcast and what you do in your job is just to dispel the myths. And with you, the dispelling the myths is pouring your wines.
Right. I've had several very weird DTC kind of interactions where, like, I'll be there pouring my wine, and then it almost always is a young couple, and I understand what she's doing, but it infinitely frustrates me. And the guy is more well versed in the wine in this scenario, very mm-hmm. specifically, and the woman is not, and it's clearly his thing. And so they'll come up and they'll see our Chardonnay, or under our smaller family label we also do Gewurz, and she'll go, oh, can you explain this wine? Not to me, to him.
Really?
And he'll go, oh, a Gewurz, so this is going to be a sweet wine. And I have to go, I'm sorry. Is it okay if I answer the questions about my wine?
Yeah.
Like, this Gewurz is a dry Gewurz.
Yeah.
Alsatian style, like not what you're expecting. Or, so this Chardonnay, so it's going to probably be... very oaky and big because we're in California. I have to be like, again, just let me. And I don't understand. And the weirdest outcome comes from it, because he then gets annoyed, or hopefully on the more positive side, a little embarrassed.
Yeah.
And she gets jealous. And it's always, I've had this interaction so many times, and it's super duper confusing. And she's just like, why are you interacting with my boyfriend so much?
Right.
And I'm like, I'm just trying to educate you. And then just because it literally happened last night in funny DTC stories. Last night, this woman was, and thankfully I don't know her name, so I can't use her name.
Mm-hmm.
But she was like, oh, I'm impressed by your Chardonnay. I don't like Chardonnay. I only like Chablis.
Aww.
And this tastes like Chablis. And so, you know, I could get used to Chardonnay if it tasted like Chablis. And I just went, keep it inside yourself.
Keep it inside yourself. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yes. And that's probably not the first. Oh, I like Chablis. And then it's like, don't tell them.
Nope.
And again, just for anyone new listening, and if you didn't know this, it's fine. That's why you listen to different podcasts, learn stuff. Chablis is Chardonnay. It's just,
yeah.
it's just the same thing.
And to be fair, to out myself, I just, when you're in the wine business, it doesn't matter how much you know. You know very little.
Yes.
It's impossible for you to know everything. So you have to be able to be humble and not expect to know everything. And so for me, the thing that was embarrassing, I thought Chianti was a varietal for a very long time. I know it's Sangiovese. It was definitely something that I feel bad because I've told non-wine friends that Chianti was a varietal at one point. I knew it was an Italian varietal.
But I'm sure this wasn't last week.
No, definitely not. But so everyone is capable of that, the embarrassing preconceptions. But that one was just extra funny.
That one's extra bad. When someone really proclaims their love of Chablis and then they can't use the word Chardonnay, they don't realize. No. That one you're allowed to shame the person. Maybe not outwardly. Maybe inwardly. We're now doing it now sort of outwardly, but we're not saying who it is. I don't know who it is. But yes, no, you're right. Wine is one of the most humbling experiences. Because the moment you think you really know things, Italy comes out with 23 new varietals and you forgot the name of that mountain. And, oh, wait a minute, what is the wind called in Loire that impacts Sauvignon? And suddenly you're like, oh, wait, what did that?
And then, climate change has made a country that has never been able to produce wine suddenly have a wine region. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. By the way, anyone who I'm not very smart and not good at science, but when it comes to climate change, all I know is this. If England is making dry red wine, maybe there's something with climate change. Maybe maybe there's something there. How about that?
Ooh, English sparkling wine though, fantastic.
Yeah. But English red dry wine, kind of scary,
terrifying.
Yeah.
Yes, I like to say at this point in my life, I am confident in being able to give you a pretty good overview of two countries. Mm-hmm. I can tell you everything you need to know about two countries. Uruguayan wine. Mm-hmm. If you don't know, there's one varietal, and it is Tanat.
Yep, Tanat, that's right.
So I'm very confident in that.
Yep.
And then I know quite a lot about Ecuadorian wine because they have only one winery.
That makes it easier.
And it's called Dos Hemisferos.
And
I enjoyed one or two of their wines that I had. I was lucky to have them in Provine when I was there in Dusseldorf.
Yep.
But so those are two countries.
Those are two countries you can dominate in.
Yeah. And I know in 6 months, something will probably change.
And then like, damn it, I thought I knew wines from Ecuador. Now what's going on?
What's this white Tanat?
Oh, geez, I feel good in 15 minutes just on that. All right, well, I'm assuming because you got like a full day. So I'll end it off with a stereotypical question. Where do you, yourself, 5 years from now with the winery, where would you like to be? Like, where would you like to be just within the whole ecosystem of Aubin & Clément?
As in my role?
Yeah, just you.
Well, I am thankfully doing it as well. I've been able to travel and sell our wine internationally pre-COVID quite a lot. Actually, my first job for the company officially was Japanese translation because I went there for language exchange. But obviously, with COVID, that made it very difficult. I was supposed to open the market in Taiwan March of 2020. Oof. I have yet to get to visit there. Hopefully, I'll be going there soon. But so hopefully just getting back out and doing that again, weirdly enough, not anything to do with us and everything to do with the world right now. But I also am currently in charge of allocations, making sure because we're at this great problem to have if you're us, but also stressful and frustrating problem to have where we have a ceiling of how much wine that we can make and people are buying all of it. And
good,
so
it's a good problem to have, but I do understand the stress because there's pressures. Everyone wants it. And then other people discover you, then they want it. And then it's just trying to find the sense of fairness.
Yeah. And we have longstanding, like, for example, Toronto, I was at Canoe and we were presenting our wines and they've been buying wine from us for 20 years. So when we weren't in the market anymore, it was devastating. Mm-hmm. And so I want to make sure that these places that we have that have this significance of understanding our wine and wanting to show it to masses, I want to make sure that they're able to get supply. And so that's another chunk of my job. But I hope to also be one of the, eventually when we're not, when some of our fantastic older production team are retiring, to be even more of a spearhead on the blending process.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess those are my ideals for my job.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Isabel, really appreciate you taking time. You're going to have another busy day here in Toronto. And so I appreciate you taking time doing the podcast.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming. This was fantastic. I've not been asked to do a podcast where people wanted to hear about me before. So that was really cool.
This won't be the last.
Oh,
I will
you.
Say that. This will not be the last. You were great. The wines are fantastic. We had a great night at the National Club. Again, shout out to Wine Online. And people out there, if you encounter Au Bon Clément and you're worried, like, oh, no, it's California. No. I know the acidity there, the brightness, the freshness, these are wonderful wines and definitely worth your time. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.